Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final pairing in the United States Open Championship. The players are Jack Nicklaus of North Palm Beach, Florida, and Chris Mascaro of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mr. Mascaro has the honor. Play away, please.
Hey, next on the T Nation, and that intro never gets old to me, by the way. Thank you, Ron Reed, for doing that for me about a year or so ago. But next on the T Nation, thanks so much for coming back and pressing play for part 2 of this week's show, featuring my conversations with Paul Salter and Hal Sutton. Paul Salter is a hypnotherapist. This guy is endlessly fascinating. He is going to help us kind of get over some of the fears that we have out there. He's going to talk about how he does that through hypnotherapy, whether it's the fear of judgment, you know, the stuff that gets in us, right? When we're out there playing and all of a sudden maybe we're going to tee off and there's a whole group of people because the first tee is backed up, or maybe we're playing in a member guest where there are a lot of people around, whether it's on the tee or when we're finishing up or we're in a tournament and all of those sorts of things, and those fears of people are going to ridicule us maybe. We're afraid that we're going to slice one into the trees off the first tee or top it or whatever we're going to do. He's going to help us understand where that came from and then how to get over it. So I think you're really going to enjoy this first segment of part 2. And then, of course, after that, Hal Sutton. How great is Hal? Hal has been on the show now, and I'm honored to say this. This is the 15th time I've got to spend some time with Hal here on the show. We're going to get into an update of his wonderful course design, the Darmore Club just outside of Houston, and a company that got him to really endorse, if you will, or get excited about is probably a better way to put it, a putter. Hal has never endorsed a putter over the course of his whole playing career, but this company got him to get very excited about theirs. Got him to go up there and take a look at it, and he became so excited that he is now endorsing their putter, and he's doing it not because they're paying him, but because of how great he thinks this putter is. Which putter design is it? Why is he doing it? How excited is he actually about it? You're going to hear it in segment number 2. So thank you so much for being here. As I always say, you guys are the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate each and every listener so very much. Sit back. Relax. Let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. But before we get started, I want to start off by reminding you about our wonderful friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2, UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants. I also want to remind you about our wonderful friends over at Squares Golf. Before I bring them into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's SQAIRZ.com.
Sure, this is golf, but so is this. And this. And this is definitely golf. And so is this. Hey, that's not golf. Oh, wait, yeah, it is. And no matter what your golf is, you're going to need a store. No, a superstore. A place to get fit for a new club and walk out with it the same day. A place to find the perfect fit. A place to do whatever this is. Because this is golf. And this is Golf's Superstore.
All right, now making his next On the Tee debut with me is Paul Salter. Paul is a mindset coach and a hypnotherapist. He essentially helps us get out of our own way, whether it's in sports or business, plus stop spending so much of our energy on things like anger, which we don't need to do, and the self-sabotage that we also do at the source, which is within ourselves. If you're looking for a way to get unstuck from your current upper limits, with it, whether it's your income, your happiness, or more specifically to this show with your game of golf, well, Paul's your guy. He earned his Master of Science, Exercise and Nutrition from the University of Tampa, then went on to get certified in hypnotherapy. And I'm excited he is with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Paul, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, Paul, let's get right into it, because we talk on this show an awful lot about the mind part of the game and all the negative self-talk that many of us do when we're out on the golf course and seeing all the things that could go wrong with our shots. We see the water on the left, the trees on the right, the hazard in the middle of the fairway. Talk about how something like hypnotherapy can help us sort of overcome our fears, get out of our own way, and play better.
Absolutely. So we're both aware, as are all the listeners, there are no shortage of physical hazards on the golf course. You've got water, you've got bunkers, you've got audacious, terrible lies and different groups of grass all over the course meant to challenge you. But perhaps the biggest challenge we all face are the mental and emotional hazards that we are forced to navigate every hole, every round. And it's not a matter if you're going to be triggered throughout a round. It's a matter of when. Whether it's standing on the first tee box with your peers watching, whether it's facing down that 190-yard shot over the water into the tight or the pin that's tucked tight to the back right of the green. And all of these hazards trigger a pre-programmed reaction. And there's an emotional cascade, whether it's anger, it's fear, it's shame, it's regret, that begins to bleed into your self-talk, the way you think about yourself, what you believe about your worth, your deservingness, and what you're capable of. And that ultimately culminates in how you behave, how you act, which influences your results. The best part of this, whether it's performance anxiety that's triggered, whether it's anger, frustration, or regret, all of these patterns and programs are learned. Hypnosis creates an opportunity to uncover when, why, how you learned to react in one of these destructive ways, so that not only can you gain a different perspective around this type of program, but you can then begin to do the work necessary to unlearn these destructive patterns of thinking, feeling, believing, and behaving to create the energy necessary to build the patterns that align with the best version of yourself.
So let's get into that a little bit more, because I think we all want to go out and win the trophy. We all want to win the title, whatever it is. We want to win the tournament. We're conditioned, as you kind of alluded to there a moment ago, we're kind of conditioned to expect the worst instead of the best. So like, where does that come from? And how does hypnosis help you, essentially what it sounded like to me, kind of reprogram the brain?
Yeah, it's funny, as you know, I am a hypnotherapist, but really what I'm doing with my clients is dehypnotizing them. You know, our upbringing, our parents, our environment, society, our sources of entertainment begin to plant the seeds early in childhood, you know, especially those first 7 years, so formative, where we're like sponges. Science and researchers estimate the first 7 years of our life, 95% of our belief system is formed. And I'm talking about beliefs about what we feel we are deserving, worthy, and capable of. Belief about others, belief about life. So we walk around as adults carrying a collection of beliefs that aren't even ours. And as we begin to now connect this back to the golf course, the challenge most people face is rooted in fear. First and foremost, we're all, as human beings, biologically wired to fear judgment, abandonment, and rejection. I call this the fear jar. And that's simply because thousands of years ago, If you were abandoned, judged, or rejected from your tribe, well, guess what? You were kicked out and you either starved to death or you were eaten by that saber-toothed tiger. So here we see it show up on the golf course, as silly, outdated, and irrational as it might seem, when we have, for example, too much success. Do we run the risk of being kicked out of our tribe, our regular playing group, because we create envy, we create resentment and treatment between us, our peers, and our playing partners? Or do we struggle with fear of failure because we fear so much being judged or embarrassed by our peer group, the foursome behind us, or maybe we're at a tournament teeing off in front of dozens, if not hundreds of people, and we don't want to be remembered as the guy or gal that shanked one off the first tee into the water. So fear is the predominant emotion that hijacks the steering wheel and dictates our decisions and actions during a round of golf. And it's learning to diffuse that fear and infuse a sense of rationality to this outdated and irrational emotion.
So let's take that a little bit further, Paul. So how do we go about diffusing that fear? Because you're 100% right. When we're playing in a tournament, it could be even just a member guest, which no one's going to remember a week, a month, a year later. But boy, when you get on that first tee, or if you're fortunate enough to be in the twosome that has an opportunity to win your flight, and now all of a sudden it's a playoff, and now everybody's gotten in their carts and they're going to watch this playoff. Boy, the fear starts to bubble up in all of us. How do we overcome that and diffuse that fear?
Yeah, so think about this. You're 9, you're 10, maybe 11 months old. And of course, you don't remember this, but hear me out. And your parents have family over, your extended family, friends, relatives, neighbors are over, and you are in the phase of your life learning to walk. And you stand up, you hover around, grasping for your dear life to that railing, to the side of the table, and inevitably you fall. And you don't remain on the floor because you're so concerned about what everyone around you thinks. You get back up, and you fall, and you get back up. You're confident with an unwavering, relentless degree of belief and confidence in yourself. And the reason I share this is to illustrate that fear, or more aptly put for this context, concern, care, worry about how you're perceived and what other people think. It's a learned reaction, which triggers anxiety, shame, guilt, fear, whatever it may be. So really where the opportunity resides is through the use of hypnosis. I help my clients go back to the moment in their life, whether they were 17, 7, 4 years old, where they learned to overly worry or care about how they're perceived or the opinions of others. There inevitably was an experience or several experiences in which they had a negative emotion, or there was a negative reaction, a consequence associated with their behavior. They started learning they had to be very intentional in how they behaved to either earn approval, earn validation, or to avoid the pain and discomfort they once experienced by having someone have a particular opinion about them. So the opportunity resides in not only uncovering that memory moment and experience, but then allowing them to begin healing, reducing the emotional charge, and letting go of the intensity it has. Just like, for example, you pretend this memory is a Microsoft Word document. Hypnosis is like going back in, hitting the edit button, changing the narrative of the story, and placing that edited version back down into your subconscious as a memory, now leaving it with far less negative charge, which frees you up to be more present in those moments that once were so anxiety provoking.
So again, let's get into that part now, because each time we kind of go into a layer of the onion. So we go back. You help us go back, and we remember at 5 years old, you know, our parents did this, or our uncle mm-hmm. did that, or our group, you know, friends at the time did this other thing, and that's where this whole thing stemmed from, where now we have this fear. So we identify that moment. How do we get over it and reprogram ourselves that we can let that go and now move on to have a better emotional outlook?
First and foremost, through my coaching, through hypnosis, we create an opportunity to diffuse the stuck emotion that's been repressed for far too long. So emotion is nothing more than energy in motion. And if it doesn't have an outlet or an opportunity to be released, which is incredibly frequent when we're very young in adolescence, because we lack the emotional maturity, wisdom, awareness, or toolkit to manage our emotions, because guess what? We're still a child. So this emotion left with no place to go, it's energy again, but it gets stuck. And if you imagine waking up every single day with a finite supply of energy and then having to give a chunk of it just to hold on to this stuck, toxic, counterproductive emotion, well, it's no wonder that you may struggle doing what you already know you need to be doing. It becomes an energy problem. It's not a lack of knowledge problem. It's a mindset, an emotion, and an energy problem. So through hypnosis, first and foremost, we diffuse that stuck toxic emotion, which creates an immediate benefit of freeing you up, creating a surplus of energy that now allows you to take action consistently on what it is you know you should already be doing. Suddenly you're experiencing a lightness, an ease, an effortlessness. And as that continues to transpire, you inevitably find yourself stuck in a positive upward spiral of consistency, which breeds confidence, which breeds competency. And that's a much better place to be stuck compared to a negative doubt-infused spiral.
So let's take a little different angle on this, Paul. For those, we often hear the phrase being afraid to win. For guys and girls out on tour trying to get over the hump to get their first tournament victory, maybe it's their first major victory. For us, it could be winning a club championship, a city championship, something along those lines. It's the fear of winning. How do we overcome the fear of the very thing that we've hit all those balls to do? We've spent all that time practicing. Why would we fear winning?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I'll begin by just reiterating, this is the single most frequent challenge I help some of the best athletes, high performers, business owners, and entrepreneurs across various industries work through. It's incredibly common, and more so the higher up in the ranks of notoriety and success you go. And I think it's important to acknowledge to rationalize this fear of success, because kind of as you alluded to, Chris, it sounds silly. We pour so much of our time, our energy, and our effort into achieving this goal, yet simultaneously we are so afraid of it. And the reason is, we've all heard the cliche or the expression, success occurs outside our comfort zone. Well, we are all blessed with a subconscious mind that has one objective, and that is to keep us safe. Anything outside our comfort zone is foreign, is uncertain, is unfamiliar. It's a red flag. It's dangerous. If we have the degree of success that we desire, well, first and foremost, that requires a massive identity change. And that identity change encompasses a different way of thinking, feeling, believing, and behaving. That identity change is a threat to our current identity. And that's incongruent with your subconscious's goal of prioritizing safety. So there's a real threat at hand there, and our subconscious will find no shortage of sneaky ways to sabotage our effort. But number two, with that newfound level of success comes more pressure, more responsibility, more expectation. Was it a fluke? Did it happen by chance? Was it luck? Can I repeat that? Can I sustain that? And the thought of having to sustain the success now becomes even scarier, because it's like, did I deserve it? Was I lucky? And suddenly it's all of these competing forces that keep us grounded in a pattern of two steps forward, three steps backward. So what we have to do is begin to raise our level of safety, meaning raising the level of success of which we feel safe at. And there will be moments in said individual's past in which he has either had a taste of success or been on the verge of success, and there was a pre-programmed emotional reaction that they experienced. So we need to go back to those moments. We need to lessen the emotional charge. We need to create safety around performing under pressure to free them up, which allows them and gives them permission to stop pushing, stop pressing, trying to force the success, and instead expecting the success from a place of calm, from a place of ease. And that inevitably adds up to creating the success they've been chasing.
So this brings a couple of things to mind. You just said, you know, did we deserve it? I think about a couple of players that I've been, you know, fortunate to talk to over the years on this show, you know, that society placed on them. Ah, they got lucky to win that tournament. Ah, he's a one hit wonder. And then you layer on top now social media, where you've got so many trolls out there saying terrible things. For what reason, I have no idea. But now you've got all these societal things that are coming on to a player out there, which I can easily see turns into self-doubt. So how do we not let that happen? You know, if I'm a player and, you know, I went out and I won a major. Oh, well, that guy got lucky. We never even heard of him before. And now you got, like I say, you got the trolls out there on social media that are going to condemn the player and say he didn't deserve to win and all this. And that. How do we block that stuff out when it seems like nowadays it comes at us from so many different angles?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. Two things come to mind. First and foremost, we need to cultivate what I refer to as strategic tunnel vision. And that really implies being proactive in limiting your exposure and what it is that gets into your field of vision that you can see and hear. So maybe it is removing the apps from our phone, finding every opportunity to remove the noise from our environment. And that's easier said than done. These apps are built to be addictive. They're designed to get us to spend as much time as possible. That's the low-hanging fruit. Simple, not easy. The second part is, and I'll give all credit to Dr. Joseph Parent. We shared a wonderful conversation on my podcast on this very topic. But when we talk about confidence, there's essentially three types of confidence. So you allude to this example that's also all too common, where somebody wins, you know, that first big tournament, they get their first PGA Tour win, or they win their first major. And what next? Was it a fluke? Can they repeat? Well, we can look at that person further and begin to determine, what degree of confidence do they have? Is it a level of arrogance where they're more or less just trying to feel and share all of these confident word choices and the way they present themselves just to try to convince others while they're simultaneously convincing themselves they're confident, though they're lacking it? Or is the person who won that tournament conditionally confident? They only feel confident when they've recently won or when external circumstances help them to feel good. What we're really looking for here, Chris, is the individual who is unconditionally confident no matter what, an unrelenting belief on themselves. And a lot of their upbringing and environment is going to influence that. But just as we learn to doubt ourselves, this confidence, this unrelenting belief can also be learned as well. And that's really what the nonstop commitment and action around the mental game needs to prioritize, is constantly building your mental bank account of confidence and belief, making daily deposits to ensure you are always in the black in that department.
I love it. Paul, for the people that are out there listening, or like me, that say, I need this guy. Boy, this sounds intriguing to me. This could make a huge difference in my life. How can they get in touch with you? How can they follow you? How can they learn more about it? What do they need to do in order to spend more time with you?
Yeah, go check out the Scratch Golfers Mindset podcast, particularly episodes 65 and 67. 67 will give you a much deeper dive into hypnosis, what it is, what is not, the science behind it, how it works, how I utilize it to help my clients have massive success. And episode 65 will dive deep into this concept of the upper limit problem, the fear of success that we discussed here tonight. And then aside from that, at The Golf Hypnotherapist on Instagram, thegolfhypnotherapist.com are two other opportunities to learn more about me and even set up a time to have a further conversation.
Awesome. Paul, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. You're fantastic, my friend. I hope we get this privilege of having you back on the show again soon.
Chris, likewise. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Take care, Paul. The best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Cheers.
See ya. That is Paul Salter. Again, Scratch Golfers Podcast, episode 65 and 67 for the topics that we discussed here tonight. At The Golf Hypnotherapist is where you can follow him on social media. I am absolutely fascinated by this and this topic. I can't wait to have him back on the show just to talk about me And hopefully we can get some, you know, input from you guys as well, because this stuff is fantastic. And to go back and to be able to figure out where it all started and to release that and to be able to move forward from there, I mean, that's fascinating to me. I guess we all learned it somewhere, and we got to figure out where that was so that we can get rid of it and then block out all this craziness and all these trolls out on social media. Folks, I can't tell you enough, please don't believe everything you see out there on social media, particularly if it's the accounts that have a couple of followers and they want to come and troll you. Just mute those things, block those things, and move on. Don't give it a moment's thought that this could be real, or this guy or this girl or this account may be right. No, they're not. They're just being stupid and trolls. I can't tell you how many I see out there, particularly on X, every single day. So let that stuff go. Don't give that a moment's thought. But let's figure out where this whole thing started and where we feel like, you know what, hey, if we got a fear of winning and that is the very thing we're out there trying to do, let's get rid of that and move on and be more successful. Paul's going to help you do it. And we'll get him back on the show and we'll talk more about it, hopefully before too long. All right, now back and next on the tee with me is a guy who's become a wonderful friend that I admire greatly. And that's PGA Tour legend Hal Sutton. For those of you who haven't joined me before when Hal has been a part of the show, I want to give you a quick reminder of a resume that I think should be one that's worthy of being in the World Golf Hall of Fame. He was named the 1980 College Player of the Year, won 14 times during his college career at Centenary in Louisiana, was a two-time All-American, led Centenary to the NCAA tournament. He was a two-time Trans-American Athletic Conference Player of the Year, won the 1980 U.S. Amateur Championship, turned pro in 81, got his first win on tour in 82 at the Walt Disney World Classic, and that year he was named the Tour's Rookie of the Year. The following year, in 83, all he did was go out and win the PGA Championship and the Players' Championship. 1998, he won the Tour Championship here in Atlanta. He famously beat Tiger by a stroke at the 2000 Players' Championship. He captained the 2004 U.S. Ryder Cup team. He backed up his 14 college wins with 14 more out on the PGA Tour. He also finished second 18 times, had 135 top 10s, 239 top 25s. And like I said, how that's not in the World Golf Hall of Fame with Hal Sutton, no idea. But I know I am thrilled to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Hal, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, Chris. It's always good to talk to you.
And happy belated birthday, my friend. April 28th, turned another year. Did you have a wonderful birthday?
just another day, you know. 67 years I've been on Earth here. So a lot of that battling a golf ball. So,
no doubt.
Yeah.
Hal, give us an update before there's a couple specific things I want to talk to you about tonight. First, I want to get an update on the Darmore Club that you opened up and designed last year. How are things going out there?
It's going great. We were just voted best new golf course in Texas and fifth overall in Texas, and that's the highest ranking for a new coming golf course since Dallas National came on the scene in 2004. So I felt really good about that rating, and you know, it's fun, it's different. There's nothing in Texas like it. I mean, we did the templates that CB McDonald and Seth Rainer laid out there for us, and everybody seems to love it. We don't have any water on the golf course. Not many golf courses in the United States can say they have no water. But anyway, hopefully trying to help people learn how to use the ground and not be so one-dimensional with a range finder and just go right at the hole. You know, there's a whole lot more to the game of golf than using a range finder and going right at the hole.
Hal, I was admiring the golf course and the area views that I saw out on Golf Pass. The course has a rating of 75.7, a slope of 140, and it plays at 7,241 yards, probably from the tips. Those sound like a course and a rating that could host a tournament one day, be it in a college tournament, an amateur tournament, or who knows, maybe even a pro tournament. Could you see something like that happening somewhere down the line?
And I don't foresee that. Maybe a college tournament at some point, but you know, Columbus is 35 miles west of Katy, and Columbus is only 3,500 or 4,000 people. So, you know, we're not really prepared for a big event. We've got our pick and shovel next week, which is our member guest. So that's our biggest tournament yet. So,
all right. Looking at those satellite level views of the course, like I say, one of the things that I've wondered about with respect to golf equipment and the golf ball controversy and all of those sorts of things and how far the golf ball flies nowadays is why more courses don't kind of retrofit themselves where we've got fairway bunkers and hazards out in the landing area. Maybe it's 300, 320 yards, whatever it is, making players having to use more imagination, get a little more creative than just like, as they say, the bomb and gouge game that we have nowadays. And when I look at the course design, you've got holes like number 4, 14, 16, 18 in particular, where it looks like you've created some things out there kind of in the bomber's range where they may have to think twice, maybe use some different clubs, maybe go through their whole bag as they're going out and playing out at Darmore. Talk about strategically what you did to kind of bring more artistry back into the game.
Well, first of all, McDonald and Rayner love cross bunkers. So, you know, I didn't put as many in as they probably would have put in, but the cross bunkers can eliminate people going further if you want to. So we've got some of that. The fairways are pretty wide. I did that on purpose because when I was playing on tour and we had pro-ams, I noticed that amateur players, if the hole was tight, they felt a little debilitated, like they were defeated before they ever hit the shot. And I noticed that when the fairways were wider, they felt a little freer and didn't feel like they had to tighten up and couldn't. They could find the fairway, in other words. And so I kind of made Darmore a second shot golf course. There's 5 par fives and 5 par threes, which those are usually fun. The hardest holes on the golf course usually are par fours. So I put 2 par fours on it that you could drive. I've got 3 of the par fives from the tips are over 600 yards. So, you know, there's a lot of variety on the golf course. Because it was built in a mine where it had been mined 130 years ago. It's some very interesting holes on the golf course. We've got 2 blind shots and 1 totally blind and 1 partially blind. And the 1 par 3, the second hole, is really the template is the Dell, which is at Lahinch in Scotland. And we've already had 7 hole-in-ones on this hole.
Wow.
So, and it's totally blind. It's 135 yards. And, you know, if people would learn to just accept and free up to hit these shots, I mean, I think that's amazing that the blind shot and the 7 hole-in-ones already on the hole. You know, it's just freeing you up. You have, it's kind of like when COVID, when we had COVID and everybody was playing golf and there were no pins in the green. So everybody aimed at the middle of the green. And, you know, it's really interesting, Chris. Everybody said they played better all during that time. And they have completely forgotten that they aim for the middle of the green. See, they can't get the pin out of their mind. They end up short-siding themselves a lot. And they end up making bogeys because it's really tough to get it up and down from short-siding. So, you know, hopefully at Darmore, have put some of that back into the game and players will remember that.
So let's take that a step further, Hal, because that is something I've tried to adopt in my game because I'm just a weekend warrior. So the idea of actually trying to shoot at a pin to me makes no sense. I'm not that good. So for those that are like me, should we kind of get that out of our mind? Because to your point, we go out there with our rangefinder and we shoot the pin and now we're going right at whatever it is, as opposed to looking at the green, trying to play for the middle of the green. That gives us some opportunity to have some you know, plus or minus errors, if you will. So if I'm whatever the green is, if I'm playing toward the middle, let's just call it 150 yards. If I just aim for that, if I hit it a little thin, maybe it goes to the back of the green. If I hit a little fat, maybe it comes up at the front of the green. And if I push it a little or hook it a little, at least I'm still around the green. As opposed to when you've got a back left pin and the other side of that is it's going to run off the green and into the rough, or maybe there's a bunker back there, or who knows what trouble lies back there. Would we do ourselves a favor for just playing for the middle of the green every time?
Well, you know, I would say yes, but, you know, there are those exceptional players out there that, you know, aiming at the middle of the green is only on an occasion that they would do that. You know, one of the things that I'll add to what you were just talking about, aiming at the middle of the green, you said 150 yards. You know, there's three clubs you could probably hit 150 yards in your bag, but you would choose the one that will only go 150 yards if you nuke it. And most of the time, we're short because no one will ever pull enough club. Jackie Burke, my good friend, who's not with us any longer, used to tell me that the right club is whatever club you can easily hit over the green, and then you back up a little bit. So, you know, most people out there that are listening to us right now, if they're really truthful with themselves, they know they don't hit enough club most of the time because they fear going over the green. So, you know, so seldomly do people hit it over the green that I don't know why they're afraid of doing it. But anyway, pull more club. That's all I'm saying.
So how do you back up? Let's take that a step further, right? If 150 yards for me is, like you say, if I nuke it and I hit it in the middle of the face and all that, everything goes perfectly, and I do that, you know, 2 out of 10 times, but I can take a 7-iron and hit it 160. How do you make that adjustment? How do you back it off?
Well, you know, I just rotated slower is what I did. You know, body rotation. I mean, I always tried to connect my arms to my body, and the speed of my rotation dictated how hard I hit it. You know, I never tried to, I wasn't one of these guys that I was trying to hit it hard all the time. You know, my good friend Nick Price used to say, "Why don't you swing at it a little harder, Hal?" I always thought I was swinging at it hard. It was, you know, I never did swing at it hard. I watch these guys today, you know, and they swing so fast. And I never tried to create that kind of speed. I was trying to control the shot. And different game now.
Indeed it is.
You see how relaxed I am about it, Chris. I don't have to wake up tomorrow and play really well.
Hal, I want to switch gears a little bit because you recently started partnering with Makefield Putters. You've never endorsed a putter in your career that I'm aware of. When I take a look, you know, these guys have something really special going on. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts about what made you decide that this was the putting manufacturer that you wanted to align yourself with.
Well, you know, I liken this to when the metal woods came along. You know, I was that changed the game more than anything else in the world. And I was really slow to go to it. Still had an old McGregor persimmon that had been good to me, and I was going to stay with it forever, you know. And the one thing that I'm certain of, and I know everybody else is out there that's listening, is nothing lasts forever. And so I went to the metal wood, and obviously it was better for me, hit more fairways with it. And, you know, when Makefield started calling me a year ago, I kind of had the same attitude, you know. I used a Scotty Cameron Newport News forever. It's been good to me. I'm just going to stick with it. And slow to advance with the technology. And they stayed persistent with me. And finally I said, you know, let me come to Philly and I want to go through a fitting and see what y'all do and how y'all make these putters. And you can give me the engineering behind all of it. And let's see where we go. Well, when I got up there, first of all, I'll say they make every bit of it right here in the United States. So that was kind of cool. And the engineering behind it is they've got the radial cusp, which makes the ball, they're trying to get the skid effect out of the ball. So they want to get the ball on the ground quicker. And then the other thing that gets the ball on the ground quicker is the weight goes, all the weight in the putter goes through the equator of the ball. In other words, it's not below the equator. And, you know, you can shift the weight from heel to toe. They have three different weighting systems so that you can make the toe speed up, slow down, heel, vice versa, speed up or slow down, and you're in control of it. And what does all that mean? Well, once you go through high-speed cameras and you see what your stroke is doing, which mine was a tiny bit across. So what does that mean? Well, if the ball is spinning from left to right and it gets airborne whenever it hits the ground, it's going to spin to the right more. Well, I missed all my putts right when I missed them. I missed them to the right. This told me why I had done that for all these years. And, you know, it just, it was eye-opening for me. And, I mean, they really got it going on. I love how the ball gets on the ground quicker. And, I mean, they sent me my putter this last week after going up there. And first day I went out with it, I made three putts over 20 feet and didn't miss anything short. So the ball rolled good and felt good in my hand. So I'm happy I did it.
So I want to take what you said a moment ago a little bit further, because you talked an awful lot about the ball getting on the ground quicker. And I think for those of us that are out there very early in the morning, the dew sweepers out there, you get a sense of how much air your putt gets because you can see it in the dew line. And I think a lot of us get surprised with, you know, with a putter that might be 2 or 4 degrees aloft on it. All of a sudden, that ball takes several hops before it actually starts rolling, which just seems, when if you're just looking at a putter, how can that possibly be? And we don't realize how much loft some of our putters have on them. But talk about how this putter, these guys, with the, what the engineering that they do, helps get the ball staying on the ground for more of the putt.
Well, most putters have 4 and 5 and 6 degrees aloft on them. And, you know, some even more than that for guys that want to forward press their hands. You know, Makefield only has 2 degrees of loft. And I was a little concerned about that whenever I first went up there. But, you know, that's old school thinking. You know, again, that's Hal Sutton being slow to adapt to the technology of today. And, you know, the radial cusp that on there, it kind of grabs the ball, gets it on the ground quicker. I think it's pretty cool, actually. I love the weighting system that's in the putter. They have like 6 different necks that can go. I mean, they're evolving as they go. They just keep improving the putter. And, you know, I wish I had had it whenever I was playing. But technology is, you know, it's coming fast, but it wasn't fast enough for me.
How so much in putting, I believe, just like the rest of our golf game, confidence plays such an important part of it. If you feel like you're going to make the putt and you're confident when you're standing over the ball, a lot of times the ball finds the bottom of the cup. Is there something about when you put the Makefield putter in your hands that started to instill some confidence within you? And then when they delivered it, you went out there and, like you said, all of a sudden now you're starting to drain a whole bunch of putts.
Well, you know, I think going through the fitting that I went through and understanding my putting stroke and then getting the correct putter in my hand for that, I had confidence before I'd ever put a ball down on the green to putt with it. I felt like I was ahead of the game with the things that I had learned. So, I think it's a complete system. You need to understand the whole thing, really. And, whether you go and get fitted for it or not, if you know you're across it, most people know they're across it. I wasn't a whole lot across it, which is a cut putter, basically, but I was enough that if it caused me to miss some to the right, I knew if I had a left or right breaker, a lot of the time I missed it right of my line. And anyway,
yeah,
the old days.
So just from a learning process about yourself, did you have an idea that you were cutting across the ball? I'm sure you've talked an awful lot on this show about digging the ball out of the dirt when you were out on the range and hitting golf shots and things of that nature. And if you missed it to the right a bunch when you were putting, I have a pretty decent idea that because of how diligent you were and what your work ethic was like, that you were out there looking at those sorts of things. Did you have an idea that that you were missing to the right because the stroke was kind of outside the end and you were cutting across the ball?
Well, yeah, from time to time. I worked on it all the time. So I was trying not to do that. And, there's 1,000 reasons why you might. So I was aware of it. I'm working hard on it. I know stroke feels good right now. You get tired. You play 3 or 4 weeks in a row, you get tired. You get less aware. There's many reasons why you might, but that was a tendency. One thing that I'll say on here is, we all have a fingerprint and it is who we are. And you have that same thing in golf, and you'll always fight whatever problem that is. It can creep back in at any point in time. So, you have to fight daily to keep those little things out of your game. And that's why this game is so hard. That's why we're infatuated with it and we love it, is because it's difficult. We're always fighting ourselves to get better. We take 2 steps forward and 1 step back. It's a game that controls us, really. I'm sitting here in what is my trophy room talking to you here right now, and I'm thinking about all the past that I had on the golf course and the good. I guess you think about the good, but more than anything else, I think about the fight I had with trying to come out of a slump or whatever else. Those are where you really challenge yourself. And whether it's with a putter or a driver, you got to fight it all the time.
Al, just a couple more before I let you go. And you talk about the fight and the challenge, and you look around the room and all of the things that you won over the course of your playing career. You did an awful lot. You achieved more than 99.9% of golfers could ever hope to achieve. Do you allow yourself to focus on all the positive stuff that you did and all the wins that you had and the great things that you were able to achieve and experience in the course of your playing career? Do you focus more on the things that, that did challenge you, or the fight that you had to go through all of the time? I wonder if you get more enjoyment and you allow yourself to kind of revel in the great things that you achieve versus the struggle.
Well, it's interesting, Chris, that you bring that up. Here's what I'll tell you. I did win 14 times on the tour, but I played in 700 and something events. So, we end up being the tortoise instead of the hare, basically, most of the time. It's a fight. It's a struggle. It's a journey. My journey started when I first started playing the game seriously when I was 16 years old. And, it just never really ended. I think it's the same for every golfer that's out there. You never really felt like you got as good as you could have gotten. And you were always working to get better. And I think that's part of what brings us back every day to the golf course, is doing something a little bit better. And, you know, that's the journey. And I enjoyed the journey. You know, I mean, I look back and I learned a lot more about myself and my failures than I ever did in my successes. And trying to figure out how to get out of a slump, that was a war. You know, I mean, I can't say I hated myself whenever I was in a slump, but I hated where I was at, and I was trying to do something about it all the time. So, you know, it's just, it's the journey. It's why we love the game.
You seem to have a lot of enjoyment in life when you were going through the process of putting Darmore together. Could we see Hal Sutton doing a lot more course design work and taking what you learned from Darmore and now applying something maybe a little bit different, maybe a little bit better, maybe, you know, something that's completely different than what Darmore is? Can we see you out there doing more and more of this?
Well, you know, maybe. Maybe. I think we might even build another golf course here at Darmore and make it a 36-hole complex and build a, you know, Alistair McKenzie had 13 different principles that he felt like a good golf course followed. So I've always loved Alistair McKenzie golf courses. So we've been talking about kind of doing an Alistair McKenzie-like design next to the Seth Rayner and C.B. McDonald course that we did. So that would be fun to do that. You know, I don't know how many more golf courses I've got in me to do, but maybe.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I hope they're out there for more public consumption, because I think more people need to see the great work that you do. I think Darmore is one of the most fantastic golf courses. And I'm not saying this just because Hal Sutton's on the other end of this microphone, if you will. From what I've looked at, the pictures that I've seen, and obviously the ratings and the what people are already saying about it, it is a fantastic golf course, and I hope that more people get to appreciate your work, Hal.
Well, thanks, Chris. Always enjoy being on your show, and you do such a great job, and I hope everybody out there knows all the work that you put in to what you do.
Well, I appreciate that very much, my friend. All the best. I hope we get this opportunity of catching up with you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Hal. That is the great Hal Sutton, folks. They don't come better than that guy. Not as a player and not as a human being. He is absolutely one of my all-time favorite people on the planet. I'm so fortunate to have gotten to know Hal over the last several years and have him as a part of the show. And look, Darmore is destined to be one of the great courses and facilities anywhere in the country. And if he wants it to be, it's going to be a great venue to host a tournament one day. But I'm very excited about what he's done there, and to think that he's going to add another 18 holes potentially out there. I can't wait to see what that would look like, especially if he's going to do it after Alistair McKenzie's format. Alistair McKenzie, I mean, obviously, right? Augusta National, we all know the great places that Alistair McKenzie has created. And if he uses those templates, boy, what an exciting place that's going to be. And then on top of that, to hear about his relationship with Makefield putters, how that came about and what attracted him to their putters and what he saw. And look, if you can get a putt rolling sooner, get it on the ground sooner. I know we don't think about putters having loft and that they can get airborne, but if you've ever been out there as a dew sweeper and you've hit some of those early morning putts, you see how much it skids across the ground before it starts rolling end over end. And they get it started rolling end over end much quicker, and then it stays on that path, you're going to make a heck of a lot more putts. So I'm excited about Makefield putters and what they look like and how they perform and what it feels like in my hands, and to test it out and to see and how much better their putters can make my putts roll. Boy, I tell you what, can't wait to get one in my hand. So I'm looking forward to giving them a try, hopefully at my local PGA Tour Superstore or wherever I can go test one out. So they sound exciting, and I'm happy for Hal that he has found something that is making him excited about his own game now. So thanks to Hal for being here. I look forward to catching up with him a little bit later on in the year. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this special edition of Next on the Tee. I can't thank enough my guests, Tom Patry, Mike Malizia, Paul Salter, and Hal Sutton for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are perhaps two of the greatest PGA professionals of all time will be here. Starting with Bob Ford, followed by Susie Whaley. They don't come better than Bob Ford and Susie Whaley. So excited that I get to have both of them on the show next week. And I'm going to round things out with another legend, two-time LPGA major champion Jane Geddes, who will be making a long overdue return visit to the show. So folks, it's going to be an amazing one. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. I want to thank our friends again over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. For coverage of everything going on in Western Pennsylvania, including your favorite sports, go to triblive.com. You can find this show by then clicking on the sports section tab, and the most recent episode is going to be available front and center for you on the homepage of the sports section. Or you can click on sports and then podcast network. You'll see the Next on the T logo, click on that, and many of the most recent episodes from this season are going to be right there for you. You can also find this show over on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Player.fm, GolfNewsNet.com, pretty much anywhere you get your podcast content, Next on the T is going to be available for you there. And as always, my sincere thanks to the great folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But like I say each and every week, my sincere thanks go out to each and every one of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I can't thank you all enough. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.